Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Welcome back. In the last episode, we talked about the background of Trump v. Slaughter. In this episode, we'll be talking about the oral argument itself.
So let's get into deep into what happened in the courtroom.
This argument went on for over 2 hours. It was long. People had very big feelings about it. The Solicitor General started by calling Humphrey's executor a decaying husk with bold and particularly dangerous pretensions.
A decaying husk. That's not usually the way you describe precedent that you just merely want to distinguish.
This is how you describe something you want dead and buried. That is absolutely what he wants here. He said this was grievously wrong when it was decided and wants it overruled outright.
So we're not in the respectfully this case should be limited to the facts territory.
No, the court could still go that route, but that is not what he's pushing for. The justices also kept circling back to one question, which is, if you buy this idea, where does it end?
Basically the slippery slope question.
Yes. Here, maybe the slippery cliff. Kagan put it directly. She said that this entire brief is built on the idea that the vesting clause gives all executive power to the president, and said, okay, if I accept that, then it's a bit hard to see how you stop. He kept saying, theoretically, it could be limited. They didn't need to decide stuff. But everybody knows what's really on the table here. Kagan tried to lay it out for everybody. She went through category after category, and in none of them did he say that he didn't think that would fall if Humphreys fell. This is essentially him conceding this is what the real game is after, and there is no endpoint, which indicates he's pretty confident he knows where we're headed.
Let's talk about the liberal justices for a second. The three of them, were they all pushing basically in the same direction?
They're all trying to preserve functional government as we know it. That's clearly a sinking ship at this point. And speaking of that, Sotomayor pointed to the sinking funds and the War Claims Commission, stuff that we'd already talked about.
This case really has brought out some, what did you say before, deep feelings, because we have the Solicitor General describing Humphrey's executor as the decaying husk of a president, whereas Sotomayor is saying that if we accept the government's position, we're essentially destroying the entire structure of government.
The court will definitely try to find some sort of middle ground, but we're headed into a brave new world of administrative law here.
Were there any examples that were given as to why this might be the case?
You mean why this destroys all government?
Yeah, why this destroys all government?
There are part of the problem with SILA, I don't know how you can say it so easily, SILA, is that it hadn't been in existence for very long. So when it switched to exclusively being an executive agency, the sky didn't come falling down. And it is almost certainly not doing the kind of probing work it would have done if it had remained independent. But that's like people living on the edges of poverty are taking out higher interest payday loans kind of thing. It's not necessarily obvious to everybody what the problems are. Whereas now we have all sorts of massive agencies that control huge parts of the economy. And this will be catastrophic if these all become executive agencies.
What about Justice Jackson?
She's coming at it from a different angle. Her question is, why does the president's desire for control trump Congress's judgment that some things should be handled by experts?
That's the expertise argument we've been talking about over and over again.
Yes, she's trying to make it really clear. So she talks about a danger of the president coming in and firing all the scientists and doctors and economists and the PhDs and replacing them with loyalists and people who don't know anything.
That's pretty powerful given our current experience in the CDC.
It is. But she wasn't done. She noted that Congress establishes the agencies and funds them and can eliminate them if they want to. So this idea that they don't answer to anybody didn't really fly with her.
Okay, what was Sauer's response?
He said that that's the problem. If there's any way that Congress can control these, we don't have this true executive control that the Constitution requires.
So his answer is these agencies' answer to Congress, yes, but that's unconstitutional.
One thing you can definitely say about the unitary executive theory is that you can be super consistent with it.
And just kind of as a side note, I mean, other non-Republican administrations have argued the unitary executive theory, right?
Yes, they have. Kagan talked about it. I know she'd authored an article that was in favor of the unitary executive theory. And what she was trying to say is, well, when people first started pushing this, we didn't know nearly as much about what was going on at the founding as we do now. And now that we know about stuff like the sinking fund, we should be much more wary of believing that the founders would have wanted all power in the executive.
So what about the other conservative justices? Were they all buying what Sauer was selling?
There were a few divisions. Roberts seemed to be looking for a narrow path, not terribly surprisingly. So his questions were focused on whether the FTC of 2025 looks like the agency that Humphrey's executor described in 1935.
Because the FTC has changed a lot?
Yes, massively. So back then, it really was a much smaller body that was investigating trade practices. Now it's bringing enforcement actions. These actions are seeking huge penalties. It's doing rulemaking. He seemed to be asking, can we just rule against Slaughter without having to overrule Humphreys and just say that whatever Humphreys protected, this is not the FTC now?
Keep the precedent technically alive, but really defang it.
Yes, that's one way to read it. Barrett also seemed interested in narrower grounds. She asked whether the court needed to identify exactly where this presidential removal power came from. Could they just not be specific?
Yeah. Can we just leave it fuzzy in the Constitution, which seems like a very peculiar argument for jurists that pride themselves on originalism?
It does. There's so many interesting things coming up right now. Then Gorsuch brought up something that should sound familiar, the non-delegation doctrine.
Gorsuch's point was Congress has delegated huge lawmaking authority to these agencies. The court hasn't really reined that in. So if these agencies are to keep making law, shouldn't they at least be accountable to someone the voters elected? That's a different flavor of concern than what the other justices had represented.
It is, and it's kind of coming to the issue that's going to happen if we move what had been independent agencies into the executive branch. This is power that it does seem likely Congress did not intend to delegate entirely to the executive.
You get this interesting moment in the argument where Sauer mentioned Justice Scalia's famous line from Morrison, "This wolf comes as a wolf." And then Gorsuch said there are a lot of wolves around here. And Sauer responded that this particular wolf is Fenrir. I'm sorry, Fenrir?
The giant wolf from Norse mythology who will devour Odin during Ragnarok.
So the Solicitor General was comparing independent agencies to an apocalyptic wolf god.
He was. He's saying that, yes, there are lots of wolves we're going to be taking down, but this is the biggest, baddest one that we should attack first.
How did Slaughter's lawyers do?
Her lawyer made smart moves. He had clerked for two of the conservative justices, so he knew his audience. And he conceded that Seal of Law, look how easily that flowed that time, that CFPB case, that was correctly decided.
Well, that's a pretty big concession.
It certainly is a strategic one. It's giving him some credibility, but it's hard to imagine anybody realistically getting up there and saying that Sela was wrongly decided, because that is definitely not the direction the court's headed in.
So his line was, we are asking the court to adhere to all of its precedent. Petitioners are asking you to abandon precedent after precedent after precedent. Did that resonate?
I think that would have resonated a lot more 5 years ago. I don't know if that really means much to the court now. He made some practical arguments that seemed to land with some justices. He pointed out that if the government's theory is right, every president can come in and clean house, which we would expect them to do. They can fire all the commissioners. They can replace them with loyalists. We're going to have constant flip-flop.
Which is very different from the Chevron flip-flopping we've already talked about.
Yes, Chevron was incredibly problematic, and we needed to destabilize the administrative state in order to fix it. And now we need to destabilize the administrative state even more to enable more flip-flopping.
The regulatory whiplash is going to be even worse.
You listened to the whole thing. Where did you think it was headed?
But I really felt like there were justices that it's very clear where they were going to land. I thought Kavanaugh and Alito are very clearly on the government side and will rule for the government and give the maximum amount of authority. I thought that the three liberal justices very clearly are in favor of upholding Humphrey's executor. And I really felt like the other three justices, the four justices, Gorsuch, Roberts, Barrett, and even Thomas's initial questioning did not tip me off that he was necessarily going to be as pro-executive as I think our instincts all suggest that he will be.
And the administration will win. The question is just how narrow the holding is going to be. I think the three most conservative would absolutely just overturn this. There is no such thing. But I think that the overriding concern among most people there is we do not want to lose the Fed. We cannot let Trump run the Fed.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say. This theory says that anything other than direct control is unconstitutional, except for where it would be super bad. And then we'll make an exception. I think in order to avoid having to say that, they will do a narrower decision.
Yeah.
It'll just be like, all we need to decide is whether the FTC of today is different from the FTC when Humphreys was decided. It is. We're done. She can be dismissed. The question isn't just, is the FTC unconstitutional?
Yeah.
They know this applies to functionally every independent agency. I just don't think they'll necessarily go and say that right now.
So no question then that the government is going to win. Just the question is how big?
Yes. That's all this comes down to right now.
Why are you so confident?
We can certainly start with the fact that they took the case before the D.C. Circuit had decided. So they understand that under their precedent, the D.C. Circuit will be upholding Humphreys, and they don't need to see how that happens. Everybody, I think, knows it is going to fall. The question is just, how narrow do we keep the ruling?
Okay, so that's telling, right?
Yes. There are some other issues that are importantly really on the table right now. If we get rid of every independent agency, some of them really do just do pretty adjudicatory functions. And if the president gains control over those, that will be really problematic. There's levels of problems, but that's definitely partway up the ladder.
So let's talk about these outcomes. Give me the menu. What are the possibilities that we're looking at?
All right. Option one. This is the full Monty. Humphreys is overruled. For cause removal protections for any agency head exercising executive power is unconstitutional.
That would hit every multi-member independent agency.
Yes. All of them. The FTC, the SEC, the NLRB, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the FEC, all the acronyms.
Okay. All right. So aside from administrative Armageddon, let's see what option two is.
This we could call the Roberts special. They say that whatever Humphreys protected, the FTC doesn't qualify for. He was kind of probing this in his questions, that the 1935 FTC might have been some sort of quasi-judicial body, but the 2025 FTC is an enforcement machine. Humphreys could survive in theory, but this FTC would fall out of it.
It's like the airline saying your boarding pass is still valid, just not for any actual flight that you're going to take this year.
Yes, but you'll only find that out by going up to counter after counter and asking whether it works there.
Basically, does this boarding pass work at the SEC? Does it work at the FTC? Does the SEC function like the new FTC? It really raises a very factual question on all these agencies.
Yep, we litigate it agency by agency. That does make it really easy to keep the Fed.
Okay.
But it means that this is going to be a really slow, painful process.
And lots of uncertainty.
Yes. Uncertainty as far as the eye can see.
Okay. Option three, then.
We could potentially do some sort of balancing test. There was some talk about what was a core presidential power. So maybe there could still be something that survives as an independent agency.
Is this part of the severance discussion that the justices were having?
There's some issues, though, because almost every agency does something that everybody would agree is executive. This is why when we were talking about Humphreys the first time, we said, yeah, they're saying quasi-legislative, quasi-adjudicatory, but everybody would put it in the executive branch.
This get any traction with the justices?
I really don't think so. This is, again, it means it's easy to save the Fed. So that option alone means it's potentially on the table, but it's a lot harder to find something based on the unitary executive theory, which again argues that all power must be vested in the president when you're saying, well, we're going to take it on a case-by-case basis.
Now it gets awkward, right? Because removal restrictions then are unconstitutional, except when we like them.
Yes, and Kagan pointed that out. This is very intellectually wobbly. But sometimes courts do wobbly things if the stakes are high enough, and stakes can be high here.
And even the narrow option isn't really all that narrow.
It's not. So it doesn't necessarily matter whether you're knocking down a building with a wrecking ball or if you're taking it apart brick by brick, you're still ending up with a pile of rubble. The middle route just looks a little tidier while the demolition is happening.
Let's talk about this as something related to literature. Maybe one of the things that we could start thinking about is a new kind of term, naked governance. That is essentially what the Trump administration is after. They are after a power that is stripped away from any form of governance. If you remember from your childhood nursery tales, Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor's New Clothes, the emperor was bamboozled by someone who sold him clothes that were non-existent. The outcome was an emperor parading nakedly around town while the public guffawed over his new clothes, not because the clothes were there, but rather because the pretense of power was there to support the emperor's fictitious belief that he was actually clothed. So in Trump v. Kelly, the Solicitor General is the clothes maker who's trying to convince the court to pretend that this is anything other than naked governance. Is that a fair analogy?
I think it's a good way to think about it. This is definitely a pretty naked power grab. And we could potentially say that the court is trying to cloak it in the finest constitutional garments. But the difference is that in the emperor's new clothes, the emperor himself doesn't know what's happening. And here, I think everybody knows full well what's on the table.
Okay, so let's see if we got this. Two episodes ago, we explained why independent agencies exist. We used the Odysseus analogy, the need for expertise and stability, the dangers of short-term political thinking.
Right.
And then last episode, we explained the constitutional foundation and what for cause means, looking at Humphrey's executor, Myers, the ongoing tension between presidential power and congressional structure.
Yes.
And so now the Supreme Court is deciding whether any of that was constitutional in the first place.
Yep, that sounds right.
I feel like the last two episodes were the prequel, and now we're finally at the battle scene at the end of our trilogy.
We are, and the court is holding the lightsabers. Trump v. Slaughter is the culmination of most of what we've discussed up to this point. If the court sides with Trump, and it will, at least to some extent, the entire architecture of independent agency changes overnight. I don't even think we need to talk about the possibility they could side with Slaughter, really.
So then when will we know?
Probably a few months. This is moving quickly, but I don't think it'll come out as fast as the tariff will. So spring-ish. I don't think this is going to be dropping the last day of the term.
Okay.
But when it does, we'll address it.
And we'll have a new episode about it.
We will.
It'll almost be like a choose-your-own-adventure kind of book, except we know exactly where the pathway is leading.
Next episode, we're going to be shifting gears. We're going to start talking about some of the major doctrines that define rulemaking. We will be talking about the major questions doctrine, and then after that, Chevron, Skidmore, Loper Bright, and Corner Post.
For Administrative Remedies, I'm Mark Rourke.
And I'm Gwen Savitz.
So that does it for today's episode on Administrative Remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law. Because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.